The Rundown, Part 8, A Far Lost Story by John Miro.
Twilight fell upon the darkening road. I found myself again alone. Street lights went out by one, by two, by three. Now reveled in the shadows that had grown. Yes, I reveled in the darkness I'd known.
Loch Law is big. Most descriptions of the city's size start with the city walls, a common feature to all six of Casti's sky cities. In Loch Law, the walls reach over 60 stories tall, over 2 kilometers, and 91 kilometers across at their widest. Sonic shields keep the pressure within the walls, which encircle 6,000 square kilometers of pressurized living area, all kept safe from the turbulent jet streams and low atmospheric pressures of the altitude that the dragons chose as the sweet spot for all their cities. May the dragons and their loyal tears burn forever. Indeed, the dragons may be extinct, but to any tears still surviving, walking Loch Law under assumed names, eking some small existence in their small corners of the city, that they used to rule with iron fists and tentacles for their dragon masters, well, they would be hard-pressed to recognize the city from the inside. Decades of change, of tearing down the dragon throne halls or building over them, generations of political parties and rebuilding efforts, hard-fought battles to remake the city in the image of the races once enslaved here, have completely remade the city. Except, of course, for the pier. And for Piertown. In Piertown, kilometers of industry and shipping press in on one side, and massive utility stations doling out over a third of all heating, filtration, and power requirements in Loch Law press in on the other. The sky here still turns dark under outgassing, shipping vehicle emissions, and the few pollutants the city systems can't immediately swallow up. On busy shifts, smog hides most of Piertown where it rises in blocky steps, extending from land level at the base of the wall to climb almost 40 stories to the gateway through the wall and out onto the once proud sky road. Closer to land level, reclamation towers and corporate headquarters block out much of the sky. Visitors to Piertown call it an ugly place, but the locals are proud. They know that they move the lifeblood of Loch Law in from the pier and out to the hungry holds of all her trading partners. The few visitors to Piertown seldom make it past the first few climbing blocks. Almost none spend their loo to ride the mag cars up to the pier. In fact, most never make it 2 blocks past the Piertown station for the outer ringway. Piertown is still more factory park than actual town there. Perhaps the reason for its bad reputation has less to do with the ugliness of the place, more than the ugliness of its visitors. Activists decrying the working conditions forced on poor locals by businesses or the city, migrants looking for a new place to call home, or criminals scraping a life in hiding here off the grid. Entire neighborhoods of Piertown are off the grid. Cameras and sensors do not work there for long. Perhaps tier scum still do hide in those few dozen hard blocks, if the locals haven't long ago skinned them on those dark streets where no electronic eyes can see. 3 blocks outward of the Piertown Ringway station stand the last working surveillance towers. Mostly working, at least. The outward side of the tower is a mass of impact scars, dents, and half-melted sensor gear. From there, it's a straight shot down Inner Pier Road to the wall. A couple blocks past that tower, and a couple more to the right, stands the Piertown Roadhouse. It's just the roadhouse to anyone who you'd find inside. It opened its doors before they finished the wall, according to legend. The roadhouse is a 4-story place. Rooms for drinking and gambling on the first floor, rooms for sex and higher-stakes gambling on the second floor, and 1 big room on the 3rd floor, for safe harbor. The 4th floor is private. The owner lives there. The 3rd floor of the roadhouse has seen some things. Gang wars have been settled there. Criminal empires have changed hands there. Politicians have sealed their fates there. More than one murderer has found justice there, of one kind or another. There are no lifts in the roadhouse. To get upstairs, you have to walk the stairs or ride the ramps. The stairs creak and groan, and the ramp tiles make a lot of noise, and most who frequent the place say that's a good thing, that they don't trust ramps that carry strangers up and down too quietly. The tables along the walls are the first to fill up, and the chairs with their backs to the walls at that. The roadhouse is just that sort of place. The walls are reinforced and transparent, and the locals all have their favorite spots. A long wood bar runs from the kitchen on the wallward side straight through to the center of the room. The night Roland Byrd escaped on the pier started out as usual on the third floor of the roadhouse. The sky still had a spark of color. The sun hadn't yet set on the far side of the city. The windows were displaying games for some of the locals, and the bulky suits of stevedores and plant workers filled the spaces around half the tables. A man of medium height and medium build stood at the window, staring out at the dying sun. Its red glare was faded almost to yellow. It reminded him of shanties about Earth's sun. He shrugged his shoulders and hard, surgically implanted metal exoskeleton and dispelled those thoughts. He was here on business. The space around the man was empty. Even those who didn't recognize him took one look at the hardware fused to his body and the way he carried himself, and instinctively knew he wasn't the kind of man to trifle with. The roadhouse attracted rough men by the dozen. An exosuit alone wouldn't cause more than the usual wariness here, where half the sentients in attendance had one strapped on or wired in. It was the complete stillness of the man. He might as well have been a statue as he waited for the man he had come to meet. "Drink something, Murdo. I've got to relaminate the armor on that window you're staring out of soon, so maybe order something expensive," came a softer, higher voice than the man had expected. The man turned his body at the sound of his name and smiled a predatory grin. "Heard a rumor the roadhouse had a change of ownership." A gaunt woman with black hair hanging over her right shoulder stepped into the pool of light coming through the window. Murdo catalogued the tattoos on the left side of her neck, the shaven scalp on the left side of her head. He ignored the data streaming across his eyeball, and he knew who this was all too well. Jean Kelly. So, Murdo thought, the rumors were true. "Don't be silly, that's a story we tell the children," the woman said in the same voice Murdo had known. But not the same voice. Murdo felt his body stiffen with surprise as the data stream scrawling in his field of vision changed from white to red. This time, he did pay attention to the feed and could not quite hide his emotions from filtering through his body, though only someone very skilled in observation would be able to read them. Jane, who was not Jane? She seemed to be so skilled. "The roadhouse has only ever had one owner," she said, leaning against the window beside Murdo. "And their name is Ada."
You have been listening to The Rundown, a far lost story, written by John Miro. Learn more at servingworlds.com. Opening music, "Everything Is Not What It Appears," kindly provided by Nate Maingard at natemaingard.com. Closing music, "Full On" by Kevin MacLeod of incompetech.com. If you like what you hear, you can become a patron and support more stories at patreon.com/servingworlds. Thanks for listening. See you next week.